So I'm sure we'll have a few people wandering in. You know, it's Christmas season. So I want to introduce Lonnie Jarrett. I'm sure most of you know Lonnie and know of Lonnie. He's the author of Nourishing Destiny, The Inner Traditions of Chinese Medicine. I always forget the second part, but I had the privilege of seeing Lonnie speak at the Pacific Symposium, which was awesome. Just completely different than anybody else, right? Everybody's kind of on a track, and Lonnie's kind of doing what Lonnie does, which is brilliant.
I like hearing the other people.
So Lonnie brings a really different perspective, and that's one of the reasons that we wanted to have him here, and we're very honored that he agreed to come here. And a couple of his books are over here. John brought in Nourishing Destiny, which I mentioned, and then the Clinical Practice of Chinese Medicine. Also, John, if you, John Coco, I think you all know. John, will you stand up for a second?
Maybe people could walk in the back instead of the front.
That's okay. So Lonnie will be here this weekend, on Saturday and Sunday, doing a five elements clinical approach. Several of the people in here have been doing work with Lonnie and speak really, really highly of him. And he's going to be doing a series coming up also. And so if you're interested, John Coco tells me that if you want to do the weekend, you can still get the early bird price. They've extended it to people that are here. So if you're excited to be into this and you can do it, I highly, highly recommend it. So that will be 9 to 5 at AIMC. Tomorrow and Sunday.
Next time we're going to have a really, really early bird price. And then our early bird price. And then a somewhat later bird price.
So I'd like you all to help me give a hand to Lonnie and welcome him here.
Thank you. Well, thank you to the two of you for hosting me here. It's a pleasure to be here, and I love coming out and meeting people. And thank you all for coming out on a Friday night when you could be at Yoshi's listening to good jazz. What? Tomorrow night it's Mike Stern and Michael Brecker.
Randy Brecker.
Randy. Oh, Michael died, right?
Yeah, Randy.
The other Randy Brecker. And anyway. It'd be a great show. I'd be there, but it's in San Francisco, and I'm teaching in Oakland.
But we're going to go.
Are we going to the show?
Tomorrow, the last one to go, so let's do it.
You're going to go? I'll be there. You're all welcome to come. It'll be fantastic. So, So I've been coming out, and I'm be coming out a few times a year to teach here. And in May, was it May, I think, I was out, or June? We did a very successful Pulse class. So just a little bit about me. I wrote my college entrance essay on Chinese medicine in 1975, so it's what I've done for most of my life. You couldn't really be a Jewish kid on Long Island in 1975 and think I want to be an acupuncturist. So I went into graduate school in neuroscience. And by the time I got through that, you could be a Jewish kid from Long Island and go into acupuncture. So I went to a five element school in Maryland, which I graduated from in 1986. I met Leon Hammer while I was in acupuncture school, and I spent 10 years organizing all his seminars for him, studying pulse diagnosis with him. And I studied herbalism with Ted Kapchuk for 2 years, which was probably the best course in the country at the time, and that was 150 hours. So, Ted is Ted and he's brilliant, but today you get like 600 hours. So I've been on my own practicing for 29 years in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, full time. And have arrived at my own synthesis, which is somewhat idiosyncratic, but I seem to be able to communicate it to people. So when I come and I teach, like I'm teaching for the weekend, I'll be teaching Saturday, Sunday, so there's a lot of technical information. But what I like to do is I like to meet people. And So I told John, look, on Friday nights, let's just do a free lecture and invite anyone who wants to come. And when I do this, what I like to do is, since it's free, give myself all the room in the world to just speak about the stuff that really interests me. and to sort of improvise and talk off the top of my head about what I'm passionate about in the medicine. So look, Chinese medicine is really, it's more than just medicine. I mean, it's more than just medicine for the individual. We live at a time where the planet is suffering greatly. We live at a time where not only are the 85% of the planet suffering terribly and really suffering, but the 15% that has an education and lives in a free country and is middle class or higher are suffering at their own hands terribly for absolutely no reason whatsoever as well. And so at least that 15% has to sort of cut it out, because we've got the resources and the time and the education to really make a difference for the other 85%, right? So we have to probably get over ourselves and to whatever extent we can, renounce needing to heal ourselves so we can take care of other people, which is hard to take care of other people if you're lost in an endless process of healing yourself. So what I've noticed from look, anybody who can pay $25 a week for acupuncture is living in the top 10% of all human beings on the face of the planet. Down in Guatemala, people earn $1.50 a month, right? So if you're talking about getting $25 for a treatment, I mean, I'm not good at math, but that's about a year's work for a 45-minute session. So anyway, what I want to talk about tonight, I know that we sort of had a title, but I'm going to talk a little bit differently and a little more than just the title. So what I have noticed is that when physicians go through medical school, they come out and their notion of what a human being is completely abstract. Do you understand? So a human being to them is like a chart with headings and numbers on a grid. Have you ever noticed that? So it's like a completely abstract notion of what a human being is. And I notice when people get out of Chinese medicine school, their notion of what a human being is equally abstract. So instead of numbers, it's all about syndrome patterns and yin and yang this and fire rising that. And it's all theoretical, and people can answer questions on a national exam to get licensed. But the actual people don't know themselves that well. They just don't know themselves that well. And really, I would say that if you want to know your patient, you're never going to know your patient to any degree more than you actually know yourself. And when you first get into clinical practice, I mean, everybody's story is quite interesting. People are very unique. And it's very interesting to listen to everybody's story, and you can differentiate them with Chinese medicine and say, isn't this amazing? This person is fire within liver, and that person is wood within spleen, and this person is deficient kidney yin and liver yin with fire rising, disturbing the heart, and it's going to the small intestine, and he's being vented through the bladder, and isn't that all fascinating? But by the time you see enough patients and you practice for a few years, there's only one person coming to you. The only thing that differs is the names, the dates, the places in their story. But there's basically one mechanism at work. You can qualify it. You can say it's wood, it's fire, it's earth, it's metal, or it's this syndrome pattern, or it's that syndrome pattern, or it's this abdominal conformation, or it's this tongue, or it's that tongue. And those details differ from person to person. But there's only one fundamental mechanism at work. So what I thought I'd talk about is my understanding, where it is tonight, how far my understanding has come tonight, on the nature of the self. Okay? On the nature of the self. Who are we? What are the different dimensions of the self? Just to try to flesh out a little bit who we are as human beings, to try to help people understand themselves for the sake of understanding their patients. And I'll just say that if your concept, most people I have noticed, if they're 10, if they're 20, if they're 30, if they're 40, if they're 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, the way most people people are oriented toward their own lives is whatever amount of life they have left, they've already allocated to overcoming the part of life they've already lived. So you see, if somebody's 27, from a certain point of view, of a certain dimension of themselves, the rest of their life is to overcome the first 27 years they had, or 35 years, or 40 years, or 50 years, or 60 years. And I just really have to emphasize that if I were running things, and maybe, you know, it's probably good that I'm not, but I probably couldn't do a worse job than some of the people we've elected. But if I were running things, and if I were running the profession, I don't know much about, I mean, I think the national exam is basically a test of your knowledge of medical anthropology. It doesn't have a lot of relevance to do with treating people in the 21st century. I can say that with confidence because it had next to no relevance with treating people in the 20th century. And now we're in the 21st century, and it just seems less and less relevant to me every day. So I think that one of the main criteria I would have for licensing, and I don't really think we should license people. I think we should let people give them a license and then take it away if they really screw up. Because I haven't really seen that licenses confer competency to people. It's just my opinion. I told you I'm just making it up as I go along here. It's a free lecture, so... So what I would want to know, I would want to be convinced that the person has come to a point in their own life where they don't need to heal anymore. They've transcended healing. That means their attention is off of themselves. Now, that doesn't mean they don't need insulin if they have diabetes. It doesn't mean that if they have a torn rotator cuff, they shouldn't go get therapy for it of some sort. I'm talking about this notion of having an endless and infinite existential problem, a knot at the basis of self, that part of us is telling us is going to be all right at some point in the future, but never now. You see? It's always going to be better at some point in the future when I get another acupuncture session, when I go on another retreat, when I take a little more ayahuasca, when I get another like chocolate mud pack or have more hot stones laid on my body, another dozen or two tantric sex sessions. But I mean, you know, out here in California, I mean, had 100 years of this stuff. And culture's still a mess, right? When you look around, isn't culture a mess? Well, so what we need to do is rectify ourselves, so we need to know ourselves. So what I want to talk about tonight is the different dimensions of the self, different parts of the self that constitute the self, in as much as I understand them. From my point of view, this is how things work, basically. We want to get the patient out of the way to whatever degree they're contributing to the problem. We want to empower people to take responsibility for every dimension of the self that they can take responsibility for. So people, you can't take responsibility for everything, right? Can't take responsibility for the fact, like, you can't look at a diabetic and say, make insulin, right? You can't take responsibility for everything, but what we want to do is really help remove the person to the source of the problem. And it's my experience, and I don't think I'm being cynical, that we tend to be the most substantial sources of problem for ourselves. So there's genetic input, there's cultural input, there's input that was beyond our control from our family. Things happened to us when we were in utero, in the crib, with a babysitter when we were 7, with our uncle when we were 12, whatever. Things happened that we weren't responsible for. But now we're adults, we got to take absolute responsibility for everything we can take responsibility for and for everything that we are responsible for. So from my point of view, what we want to do is disembed consciousness from conditioning. So there's genetic conditioning, there's cultural conditioning, there's familial conditioning, there's gender conditioning. This diamond of consciousness that we are and that we have is buried under a lot of CRAP. And we want to disembed it from that. So a general principle of Chinese medicine, at least as I learned it, is before tonifying, move stagnation. So the greatest source of stagnation is not knowing who you are, why you're here, or how to live. Right? Not knowing who you are, why you're here, or how to live. So we want to disembed consciousness from conditioning. We want to disembed the choosing capacity from conditioning so that people are increasingly free to make choices that aren't mechanically programmed into them by culture and genetics, but to make choices based on their highest inspirations in life, based on the deepest longings in their heart, right? Based on being compelled by reaching for the highest possibility that they intuit with no inherent sense of limitation whatsoever. So we want to disembed consciousness. We want to disembed the choosing faculty of consciousness so people aren't just making mechanically programmed choices like machines. Now again, I don't think I'm being cynical. I think this is just what I've noticed clinically, but most people make many of the most important choices in life, if not all the most important choices, with the same degree of consciousness, awareness, and freedom that a Coke machine has when you put 6 quarters in it and press Coke, which is no freedom at all, right? It's just a completely mechanically conditioned process. So we only have, no human being has absolute free will. No human being has absolute free will. No human being is ever going to be 100% unconditioned. That's just a myth. The idea of a perfected Buddha came from a time and culture that gave rise to notions like virgins giving birth to children and men walking on water and coming back from the dead. It's a myth. It's a myth. So no one's going to ever be perfectly unconditioned, but the good news is we don't have to be. We just have to take responsibility for whatever measure of free will we have. And it's reasonable that if a person does that, they can increase their capacity to take responsibility and increase their capacity to have more free will than they have. So the way things... Anything you do in life, if you want to be successful in acupuncture, if you get into a marriage, if you raise a child, if you have a practice, if you want to produce a record album or a play, no matter how talented you are, no matter how much you give yourself to it, there is always going to be some degree of the outcome determined by factors beyond your control. That's just simply true. But it's not true when it comes to your own integrity. When it comes to your having integrity to the highest and deepest truth that you've awakened to in life thus far, it's totally in your hands. No one can stop you. They can't stop you by putting you in a concentration camp, right? They can't stop you by putting you in a jail cell for 28 years, right? Like Mr. Mandela. Christopher Reeves, paralyzed from the neck down, that couldn't stop him. So when it comes to actually having integrity to the deepest and highest truths that you intuit, nothing can stop you from that. But it's a complete energy drain to spend your life telling yourself that before I get to doing that, I have to overcome something that happened to me in my own past. Right? So everyone spends their time getting ready to be ready. So it's sort of like the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl is going on, your team is on the field, and you're doing push-ups in the locker room. Say, you don't understand, the game is on. And they go, I know, I'm training. No, you don't understand, the kickoff was 15 minutes ago. I know, I'm training, I'm not ready yet. When are you going to be ready? When there's an opening. When the white guy with a beard on a cloud sends me a sign. But the thing is, we have a dimension of ourselves that it seems to have evolved to deny that sign because it's coming every second and moment of every day, that we're already free and we're already ready and we've never not been ready. And that everything that's happened in our lives isn't in the way of actually being alive and living right now. So the thing is, we have to become the kind of people as practitioners that inspire this kind of life and self-knowledge and depth, spiritual self-confidence, soul strength, in patience, before we even say a word, before we put a needle in, before you hand anybody an herb. This just has to be who you are, which means getting attention off the problem, because the problem is bull. Everyone who's here tonight is here because they wanted to be. That means they have expendable discretionary income. Even though it's free, you had to pay for parking. And whatever it costs to park if you got here an hour ago is more than someone in Guatemala makes in a month. You have leisure time, free time. You're here because you wanted to be. So the formulation is this. The one thing in life we have absolutely control over is the dimension of ourselves that we put our attention on. What we attend to becomes real to us. What becomes real to us, we act out of, and our actions define our karma. They define who and what we are. So that's completely in our hands. We're the only form of matter in the universe that's self-determining. Right? My dog cannot just say, I want to be a different kind of dog. I notice that Lonnie gets really bugged when I go in and out of the house every 45 seconds when he's trying to write his book. Right? He can't make that choice, but we can make choices based on higher priorities, based on deeper reckonings within ourselves. So what we put our attention on, consciousness is an amplifier. It makes things real. It makes things real. So we have absolute choice about where we put our attention. What we put our attention on becomes real to us. What becomes real to us, we act out of, and that defines our destiny. That defines our karma. That defines our effects in the world, in our relationships, in our biosphere, in the cosmos, right? That's our input to the cosmos, our choices. So what we want to do is disembed consciousness from conditioning. And I understand Chinese medicine to be the most powerful medicine on the face of the planet for doing that. So when I think of blood stagnation, I think of all the pain in one's life one won't face. When I think of dampness, I think of everything that one took in that should have nourished one, that one turned into burden instead of muscle and blood. See? When I think of phlegm, I think of inertia. You know what inertia is? That's when the alarm goes off in the morning and you go, ugh. Okay. So let's look at the different dimensions of the self. The first thing I'm going to talk about is the ground of being. So the ground of being is a dimension that most people in culture don't have any connection to or knowledge of at all. So the ground of being is, if you meditate and you're really meditating. So really meditating to me means you're not following your breath, you're not counting from 1 to 10, you're not doing mantras. Really meditating to me means you're not moving, you sit straight, you don't move. And you have no relationship to the content and quality of your experience. You renounce your life, you renounce your entire mind, you have no relationship to any of it. So if you're really meditating and you renounce your mind, and you just jump off the cliff and you fall and fall and fall and fall, you discover a dimension of yourself where there isn't a problem, where there never was a problem, where there never could be a problem, because there's nothing happening there. Nothing ever happened there. The universe wasn't created there. It's the part of yourself that wasn't born and isn't going to die. It's still, it's spacious. It's infinite. It's never any further away than the nose on the tip of your face, and there's never a problem. Medicine is based on science, and in science, we compare all observations to agreed upon standards of reference. So in Western science, we compare things to the CGS systems, centimeters, grams, seconds. And in Chinese science, we compare them to fire, earth, metal, water, wood, and the syndrome patterns, and yin-yang thinking, and the six divisions, and the three heater, and these other numerical systems. But the very best standard of reference to compare experience to is reality, non-abstract reality. And at the heart and soul of who we are is the realization that nothing ever happened, and nothing is happening, and nothing is moving. Nothing is happening. You see? That is not a question of me or you becoming aware of something out there. That is who you are in the deepest part of yourself. In the deepest part of yourself, you were never born. You never came out of the void. It seems like you're here. It seems like you're here. Right? Doesn't it? It's an illusion. It's a very compelling illusion, and it's a very persistent illusion. But anybody who will meditate sincerely will see that they're not here, that they were never born. Okay? Now, what good does it do to know that? Well, it's pretty radical to realize that actually, in the deepest part of who you are never wounded, traumatized, victimized, humiliated, or abused. That despite anything that happened in your own past, there is this dimension of the self which is infinite. There's nothing there, and yet it's more compelling part of yourself than you've ever known. It's more compelling than any dimension of yourself you have. How compelling is it? It's so compelling that when people would wake up to this in East Asian cultures, they would spend their entire lives just sitting, being there. Right? So the Buddha was a prince to inherit the entire kingdom, and his wife gave birth to a son. I mean, I don't know what happened, but this is what the book says. And he went to the door of the bedroom to look at his son's face, to see it one time before he renounced the world. And he turned from the door and didn't open it and just left. Because he had discovered a dimension of the self that was so compelling that he didn't want to have any attachment in the world. So this can be called emptiness. It can be called the ground of being, the ground of all being. Eckhart Tolle would refer to it as presencing, I think. Rumi says beyond right doing and wrong doing, there's a field, I'll meet you there. There's no distinctions. There's no distinction. There's just nothing, but it's you. It is recognized as self. And all the thoughts, feelings, and emotions and sensations in the body that one has in that context are recognized to have no self nature. They're recognized to have no self nature. In the new book I'm writing, I just finished the first chapter. It's not the numerically first chapter, it's just the first chapter I finished. And it's 52 pages just on the clinical application of meditation. If you don't know who you are as a practitioner, what are you doing in the treatment room? What are you doing? Then you're just working out in the wheel, moving people in circles around a wheel, keeping them trapped. Okay? So the person's really angry, and then they move to fire, and then they move to earth, and then circles, circles, circles. You want to escape the wheel. This is all just basic Taoism and Buddhism. I'm describing it in the same language that they did. So I just think it's so important to really wake up to this dimension of the self where there isn't a problem. Because when you do, it's very powerful. Because no matter how upset, no matter how suffering, no matter how wounded, traumatized, victimized your patient is, you're in touch with the part of themselves. And your attention is on the dimension of themselves that isn't wounded, isn't victimized, isn't traumatized, isn't wound, right? Nothing ever happened there. That doesn't mean if a woman was raped 3 days ago, you go, don't you know nothing ever happened? Right? That's not what I'm talking about. But you can sit there, you can listen from that place, which is going to evoke that response within the person who's suffering. If your attention is so deeply rooted there in yourself and you know yourself without question, without any doubt as that, the person's own consciousness will align with that dimension in themselves. And if this is a familiar dimension of yourself, you'll be able to bring people there very quickly. And that's where all treatment has to come from. That's the root. So I'm calling this dimension of ourselves the ground of being. The Tibetans would say that when you meditate, there are two dimensions. There's emptiness and there's luminosity. So there are two experiences of the ground of being. Emptiness. So the emptiness is just, this is what Lao Tzu says, the name that can be named is not the eternal name, right? So words don't really, you can't really talk about it. When you're there, you're not there. But you step back a trillionth of a millimeter from it, and it's just incredibly beautiful. I mean, oceans of exploding love, right? Then you experience that consciousness is an unbroken field in the universe, and and that you are that field and not separate from it in any way. And then you can't locate yourself. So you say, where are you? You say, I'm here. But from the perspective of really awakening to that field of self, you can't locate yourself. You see? So that would be luminosity, that brightness. So there's an infinite darkness and then this infinite brightness. And they're two halves of the same coin. Two halves of the same coin. So it's very important, I feel, for practitioners to be deeply rooted in this. You got to do whatever it takes to get there. Whatever it takes, that's what you've got to do to be able to see that. All this, everything we know, all the information we know. When I went through acupuncture school, there were 4 books on Chinese medicine. Okay, now there are millions, right? Or seemingly millions. I mean, and many of them are great. I mean, just great. You could spend your whole life if you had enough money to buy these things. And just like I wrote those too. I look at them and I like, that is like 40% of my kidney function. sitting on the table. So, yeah, but we have hundreds of like beautiful books. But the thing is, everything you know and all the technique you have can only serve this realization that I'm talking about. It's only in service of that. And it's not enough to know it intellectually and theoretically. I mean, you really have to awaken so you have no single doubt that you're not a wounded victim, and you have no single doubt that you don't need another second in your life to overcome your past. No matter how wounded or traumatized a person is, I've never met a human being whose wounds and traumas were more compelling than their potential future. So in terms of the fundamental shift we need to happen in an individual is a disidentification with the wounded, traumatized, victimized self that needs infinite time to overcome the past, and a shift to a dimension of the self, which is that explosion coming out of emptiness that's been driving cosmic evolution for 15 billion years, which is also who you are. Right? That is also who we are. So when human beings awaken to evolution, it's the universe awakening to its own self-nature, which is to develop. Right? So imagine this. So God spends 14 billion years to develop big lizards on a rock hurtling through space. And then he turns around and another rock smashes in and all the dinosaurs go extinct. So do you think what was God's relationship to that? Do you think God said, oh my God, 14 billion years I've been working on this? And I turn around for a cup of coffee, and all the big lizards are dead. I think I need to go to Kripalu and get a massage. I think I need to go to Esalen and take some more ayahuasca. You know what God's response was? It was like this: okay, we're going with the mammals. So there's just this impulse within us, straight ahead. Straight ahead. It's this explosion, right? It's this explosion. And that impulse is spirit. So spirit has two directions of transcendence. The nature, spirit is the force of transcendence. So transcendence means we have a reality, and spirit is what takes us beyond it. Okay, there are other definitions, but I'm presenting it in this way for the moment. So spirit is two directions of transcendence. One is all the way down. So all the way down is to the ground of being, right? The Shen goes into the Jing. And then that the Jing is drawn out into the world as material manifestation, as speech, right? And as action, right? So one of the directions of spirit is all the way down into emptiness. To just fall and fall and fall and fall and to just dissolve. And that's the alchemy of the Eastern traditions, of just transcending the world by going back to the origin, discovering oneself as the source. Before birth, before the beginning, there was a beginning. Discovering oneself as that. That's the ground of being. But the other direction of spirit is a transcendence from this moment into the next. It's the evolutionary impulse into the future. It's a force driving all matter in the universe toward increased integrity, increased complexity, greater consciousness, more inclusive consciousness. You see? So when human beings... So think about this. It took 14 billion years for the universe to develop an eye. So... imagine the moment when the first eye on the first little trilobite opened. So that was the first moment that the process of creation could see itself, at least in this part of the universe, right? So that was about a billion years ago, and it only took a billion years to develop the Hubble telescope. So it's a very interesting thing. So the thing that developed the Hubble telescope is just looking at itself through the telescope. So the thing that developed the Hubble telescope did it so it could see itself. You see, there's an impulse in the universe just towards self-knowledge. The fundamental motive, you say, well, why are we here? We're here to find out who we are. We're here, the universe. God was already meditating, so why are we here? God could have just stayed meditating for another 100 trillion eons. But at some point got off the pillow to create a universe. Why? Self-knowledge. At some point you'd know all there was to know about nothing. Right? So when the human eye looks through the Hubble telescope, what we're seeing is our own history and the extent of the project that we all consented to. Right? So you can't say... so when something came from nothing, was that a yes, no, or maybe? Well, it couldn't have been a no, because we wouldn't have been having the conversation, right? And it couldn't really be a maybe after 15 billion years. If you go to a restaurant that sucks, how long does it take to know it sucks? You ever look at your friend and go, God, that was the worst meal I've ever had, but maybe we should come back Tuesday and not, you know, give it another try. No, so it couldn't be a maybe after 15 billion years. That's a pretty consistent record. So it would have to be a yes. So this exploding impulse out of emptiness, this fire, this luminosity. So when the Tibetans say there's emptiness and luminosity, we see in meditation the luminosity is the yang within the yin. The yin is just empty. It's nothing. But there's luminosity. That's consciousness. That's the capacity to make the choice to become. The capacity to make the choice to become the fire within the water. And when that choice is made, there's an explosion, right? So we are that explosion. So that explosion is present in us as the creative impulse. So the lowest level of the creative impulse would be what? What's the lowest expression of the creative impulse in human beings? The sexual impulse. Who said that? You're not allowed to. You know the answer. She studies with me, so it's... Now, let other people... If I ask questions, that's all right. Look, I'll give you 97. So the sexual impulse would be the lowest level of the creative impulse. So if you're really into Tantra, you'd say, well, sexual impulse isn't a low impulse, but look, there's not much about sex that most human beings could express that my dog wouldn't understand if it was fluent in English and couldn't express also, right? Snakes would get it, salamanders would get it. Right? You understand? Squirrels. Ducks would understand it. Okay, so the thing about the sexual impulse, which is interesting, the lowest level expression of the creative impulse, this force arising out of nothing to create something, we can understand it genetically, of course, as historically the need to get more vehicles here for consciousness to inhabit. We can understand it that way. We don't need more vehicles now on this planet, do we? No, we've got enough. We got enough vehicles for consciousness on the planet now. That's at least for. It used to be just a few people woke up, and we have enough vehicles on the planet now that consciousness is spreading very quickly. We're building the internet, which is our nervous systems. We're externalizing it, and there are no geographic barriers anymore. There are no real cultural barriers on the planet anymore. I mean, people think there are cultural barriers, but there aren't really anymore, right? Because consciousness spreads mimetically. A meme is a unit of conscious transmission. Like a gene would be genetic transmission. So a meme is a unit of transmission of consciousness, transmission of values. So let's just look at the sexual impulse. Does it care about you? No. Does it care about the object of your affection? What does it want? Do you ever feel really excited sexually and say to your partner, I'm feeling really stimulated. Do you think we could set a date, maybe a Wednesday in 3 weeks? And there's no time. There's just no time in the picture, right? There's no time. It has nothing to work out. The sexual impulse, it has nothing that needs to be worked out before engaging in it, right? It's just like you and me here right now, right? You and me here right now. So there's no time in the picture. No time in the picture, and there are no ethics in it whatsoever. Any ethics that exist relative to sexuality occur at much higher levels of in the body than the first chakra or the second chakra. The ethics come out at the level of the heart, at the level of the mind, but not at the expression of the sexual impulse. So this is a lower order expression of spirit. Right? Spirit needs vehicles. Spirit, I'm making synonymous with consciousness. The next highest level would be the creative impulse. So the creative impulse would be like, you know, the impulse to create music, the impulse to create art, the impulse to dance, to do what, you know, whatever you do. Whatever you do creatively. And that's the same thing, isn't it? When you're really in the middle of creating, is there time in the picture? When I was writing these books, my children were very young, and my wife would come in at 4:30 in the morning. She'd say, Lonnie, you have to get up in 2 hours to go to work. I'd be like, I'll be there in a minute. I'll be there in a minute. Can you imagine Edison? I think he tried 1,700 filaments for the light bulb, or was it 4,000? I don't know. But can you imagine it's the middle of the night, and Mrs. Edison comes in and goes, Thomas, you have to get up in 2 hours. He goes, I'll be there soon. Don't bother me. So there's no time in the picture, and there's a total absorption. But there's still no ethics involved. Isn't that so? With the creative impulse? To know that, you just have to look at Miles Davis. Right? Or any number of people. I mean, In Miles' creative line of development, the man was enlightened. Right? He was at the forefront of every significant movement in jazz for 50 years. And he played with Charlie Parker when he was 18. Right? But ethically, I mean, he's completely debauched. Right? So haven't you ever wondered how could people be such creative geniuses and be so effed up? That's very interesting, right? So then the next highest level of expression of this creative impulse would be what I'd call the authentic self. The true self, the authentic self. Now, for the Taoists and for the Buddhists, the authentic self was that dimension of you which had awoken to its own nature as emptiness. Do you see? So it was a person would become a completely spontaneous expression of nothing. Just emptiness. You look in their eyes. If you've ever been to India, you know those guys who dress in the orange robes and beg? I mean, most of them are petty criminals. Right? They're just dressed in orange as a front. I mean, they don't have 100,000 enlightened gurus there. I mean, a lot of these guys are con men, but there's a depth. You just walk around Delhi and you just see a depth in people's eyes. There's a real depth. So that awakening to the authentic self would be the dimension of the individual that has awoken to emptiness. But we know a lot more now about the universe than they knew. Do you know that Albert Einstein, if you asked him how big the universe was, he would have said the size of our solar system? And now they pointed the Hubble telescope a few years ago at an inch of space for 12 days and got a photograph of 100 billion solar systems at an inch of empty space. So Einstein died thinking our solar system is the universe. 100 billion and counting. And it's all alive. Some of them are dying. Some of them are being born, right? It's all a creative process. We're all part of that. So it's not enough to say that the authentic self is only the dimension of spirit that returns back to the source. It's also this evolutionary impulse that awakens to self as the evolutionary impulse. What I'm calling the authentic self is the dimension of one that recognizes itself as the process of cosmic development. Do you see? That realizes not only is it in no way separate from the source of creation, it's also in no way separate from the creative impulse that is moving creation forward and has evolved it for 15 billion years. So what that means, when we awaken to that dimension of ourselves, you know, there's the sexual awakening, then there's the creative awakening. But when we awaken at the level of the heart and at the level of consciousness to what I'm calling the authentic self, there's just a felt obligation to develop in all our capacities and to be a generator of that, not just in ourselves, but in others, to be a generator of that in culture, to move things forward toward higher states of integration, higher states of integrity. This is where ethics start to emerge, where we can discern higher possibilities and make choices in our life to live now like the future we want to create is already here. You see? So Rosa Parks, for instance, down during the Birmingham bus boycott, she didn't say to herself, well, it's unfair that blacks can't ride on buses. I think I'll get a law degree, run for Senate and change some laws. She just sat down on the bus. She just lived now in this moment without having to work anything else out. Like the future I want to create, it's already here. So that's the authentic self. The authentic self is the part of us that spontaneously responds to life pre-thought in a way that moves everything toward greater integration and greater wholeness. That's where we want to be responding from as clinicians. Returning people just to peace, it's an essential awakening to be able to return, to be able to awaken to the dimension of the self where nothing happened. That's why I spent so much time talking about it. That's why I just wrote 52 pages for my book about it, because I think it's very, very critical to awaken to that dimension of the self. But it is no longer relevant as a final destination for humanity. I mean, if everybody just meditates and awakens to emptiness, you're just going to sit there and watch the world go to hell, and you're not going to care. Ramana Maharshi became enlightened in a cave and sat and was so disidentified with creation and his body that rats were eating him. Little kids would just come and throw rocks. He went down to like 95 pounds. And the townspeople had to come and get him, lift him up and feed him. He would have just died there. So there isn't the... Once you realize that everything is perfect just as it is, that nothing ever happened, that fundamentally there is no problem at the root of who you are and there is no more time needed, the function of that realization is to then give oneself to this impulse to create, not just sexually and not just at the level of art, but to create at the level of consciousness. To bring in higher stages, states and stages of human development, higher values. Don't we need higher values? Have you noticed we need higher values? Have you noticed that the people in our government, the goal of most of the people in the government is to get things back to how they were? Do you understand? We don't really want to do that. You know, you can't solve a problem with the same kind of thinking that created the problem. Right? You have to look at it from the future. You have to look at it from the future. And we can do that as human beings. We actually can intuit the future that's possible and start living now. So that's what we're vehicles for. And when you're a vehicle for that, it's not that you don't have problems, it's just that your problems, your pain, your wounds, your suffering, they don't go away. In fact, your suffering might get more intense, because you're so open. The thing is that it's all just contextualized by a care that's so much greater for something so much bigger. So where your attention is on a dimension that's so much bigger. So minimally with a patient, you want your attention on the potential of who they could be, of who they could be now, not at some point in the future, now. That doesn't mean their liver enzymes will come down in 3 seconds. They may have some horrific physical problem which they're just going to have to live with all their life. And at that level, what we can do with the medicine is palliative and help them function better, and all that's fine. But in the soul of it, at the heart of it, from a spiritual point of view, we really want people to awaken in this positive way, that their own attention is on this part of themselves that can still evolve even if they're a quadriplegic in a wheelchair. Do you see? So these are the two absolute dimensions of the self. Okay, the two absolute dimensions, emptiness, luminosity, the ground of being, and the explosion coming out of the ground of being to create a universe. These are not things you're aware of, they're you. They're you. Everybody's aware of this authentic self. Everyone in here has experience with it. But it's probably only in moments. Most people cultivate relationship to it only in relationship to a talent. So for instance, a martial artist who really trains will have moments where you bow in and the ref says go and you go bam, and it just happened. You know, or you're playing tennis and you throw the ball up and you haven't even hit the ball and you know you've aced your opponent. Or you're doing modern dance, or you're doing painting and there's just a flow and there's something happening. Most people confine that to a skill or a subset of life. This is where we have to live life from. Right? This is where we have to live life from. You really have to drop this notion that like my treatment room is my temple or my treatment room is my altar. And this notion of like bowing at the door and leaving your stuff outside, it's completely deluded. You can't leave your stuff outside. There is no outside. There is no inside. The point is to be a unified human being who's just the same everywhere. There shouldn't be any stuff to leave outside, right? It should just be, you just walk in and you're ready to go, right? You walk in and you're ready to go, like I walked in and I'm just talking. You walk in and you're ready to go because your attention is on it 24/7. That's, you know who you are, you know why you're here, you're giving your life to it, you're not ambivalent about it. You have complete and utter confidence in the positivity of the process we're involved in. That's where your attention is. You have no single doubt. You have no single doubt. And through that, we will develop the capacity to actually trust ourselves. And no one is ever going to trust anyone more than they trust their own self. So a big part of healing is restoring people's capacity to trust, but what they need to trust is themselves. And there is a dimension of the self which is ultimately trustworthy. And that doesn't mean that if you give yourself to it, you won't really screw up, right? Because nobody's going to be perfect. It just means that you're giving yourself to a pure motive, and when you make a mistake, you get to say, "I'm sorry." And take full responsibility for it and learn. And just like God saying, "Schmuck, the dinosaurs are dead. We're going with the mammals." Right? So these are the two absolute dimensions of the self. And there's another one, and that we can call ego. So I'm not talking about ego in terms of the psychological definition of ego. I'm just going to define ego for the purpose of this discussion. And I have like 120 pages written on it for this book. I just keep going and going, and I'm going to have to... That's why this book is so big. This red book, people go, "Why didn't you write about the conception and governor vessel?" I'm like, look at that thing. You have to stop at some point. You know?
It's in the black book.
Well, some of it's in the black book. Anyway, the thing is, when people say that to me, I'm like, I just say, "You write it." Or me, I could never do it. I'm, you know, it's like, I need what's left of my kidney to make it through the next few years anyway. So for the purpose of this discussion, when I say ego, all I mean is the part of yourself that's not on board with any part of you that's inspired by anything I've said. So I'll just make a black and white distinction here. The black and white distinction is between ego and authentic self, two parallel lines that never meet. So from a practical point, clinically, ego is just everything that exists within the person that opposes the progression toward greater integration and wholeness. Anything physically that opposes it, anything psychologically that opposes it, any behavior that opposes it, any belief that is against and exists in contradistinction and antipathy to the life impulse, the evolutionary impulse's unbridled passionate movement toward greater integrity and greater wholeness. So anything that resists that. So what you'll find is when a patient sits in front of you, there are always two people in front of you. There's the person who made the phone call, made the appointment, kept the appointment, walked up the stairs, is sitting in the chair and wants something. And then there's the other part of them that doesn't want to do anything to get it. So conservative people go to doctors to get drugs and surgery so they can feel better without having to change. And liberals go to acupuncturists and homeopaths so they can feel better without having to change. Do you understand? I don't want to be that kind of practitioner. I think there is a place in treatment for helping people feel more comfortable where they are, but it's very rare. If someone was just raped, if someone just got back from Iraq, if somebody's child just died, you know, 3 months, 6 months, a year, if it's current, if they're working with you and they're addressing it for the first or second time. But look, out here in California, you're getting patients who've been to 75 acupuncturists. I mean, they've done LSD. They did LSD at Esalen in 1963. And they've had 14 gurus, and they have an 8-principle acupuncturist, a Toyohari practitioner, a 5-element practitioner, a network chiropractor, a bone cracker, you know, three different massage therapists, a dance therapist, a music therapist, and they're just coming to feel good, right? The ego, what I'm calling the ego, loves healing. It loves healing. It's completely committed to healing, but it has no intention of ever being healed. You see, it loves consuming experience under the auspices of healing. It's just the ego, the postmodern ego, saying, I need more time. I need more time. I need more time. Well, what about now? Not now. Would you like to be happy now? No, not now. Could I be happy in 5 minutes? But I definitely don't want to be happy now. So what I call ego can just be understood to be the everything that blocks, obscures, and darkens the very deepest and best part of ourselves and the impulse toward wholeness by always inserting time into the picture. Always inserting time into the picture. That's how it does it. So the ego has, what I'm calling ego, has access to all our capacities, and it lives based on thought, feeling, and emotion. So there's a personal self. In Chinese medicine, you know, we have this character. Well, maybe I don't have to draw it. We have the character Shen. And we can understand that there's a Shen large S and a Shen small s. So Shen small s is the basic force of animism in you, and it's your psychology. So if you're 37 or 47 or 53 or whatever, you were conceived, and from the moment of conception to this moment, every second of your life, thoughts, feelings, emotions, and sensations have been streaming into the hard disk, creating a personal sphere of experience. The ego, what I'm calling ego, is the force within consciousness to keep all of consciousness and all of attention focused like a laser only in this personal sphere, and to aggressively deny the absolute and non-relative and infinite dimensions of the self, which are the ground of being and the creative impulse. You see? It denies them. It denies them. So the personal sphere, Shen small s and Shen large s, aren't really separate. They're not separate. Right? So your personal sphere is in no way separate from the rest of the universe. How could it be? How could it be? Right? How could it be? It is the universe. All of your memories, all of your thoughts, all of your feelings, all your emotions are just the part of the universal process that you have direct connection to through memory. They're what you saw. They're the angle you saw. So we're sitting in a room now and everybody's at their own angle having their own experience. The ego is the part that denies the one experience we're all having. Do you see? It keeps attention focused like a laser beam only on the personal sphere to create the illusion of separation. But at the moment of death, the nervous system stops being sticky and all those individual moments come off the necklace like a pearl necklace that broke and just disappear. Just disappear. And then all that's left is that dimension of the self that is empty and purely creative, with no attachment now, with no objects in its awareness, no thought, feeling, emotion, sensation, right? There's no self nature. People, the last 100 years, the last 50 in particular, there's such an emphasis on go into your emotions, get in touch with your feelings. When she moves outside of you, there's weather and seasonal change. When she moves inside of you, there's thought and feeling and sensation. It's just she moving. It has nothing to do with you. You're the one watching the movie. You're not in the movie. You're the consciousness. So you're driving down the road, looking through a windshield, and birds poop on it, and stones hit it, and mud winds up on it, and maybe you hit a bird or a deer or an antelope or a gazelle or two. I guess it depends where you live. And all this crap gets on the window, and you're just staring through it, and in time, you just think you're the crap. It's all just objects in awareness. It's not you. So what I'm calling ego is the thing that says, see this card? This card is my special problem. Let's go. Most people are like, okay. Well, I understand what he's saying. I hear what he's saying, and that's probably true about everybody else's special problem in here. But he doesn't know what happened to me. Because if what happened to me happened to anyone else in here, they'd handle it better. It only affected me the way it did because I'm really sensitive. That's the story of every patient I've ever had. Everybody believes that. That's so dehumanizing, so objectifying of other human beings to think that your special problem is somehow so unique that you can't be expected to let go of it because you still need more time. You know, I know a man who grew up in the Sudan, and he came home one day and his village was burned to the ground and his whole family was dead. So he had to go into the jungle to hide from the people who had done this, and he spent 4 days up a tree with lions circling underneath it until other people came by, and he walked with them for months until they got to the Nile River, and 150 people crossed the Nile River. 40 of them were eaten by crocodiles. And then he spent 5 years in a refugee camp, taught himself English, moved over near me in New York State. I live in Massachusetts, but just a few miles from New York. Went through graduate school and started an international foundation to build schools in his home. And he'll just look at you and say, this is my story. And he'll tell you with no victimization. And he'll say, this is what happened to me. It made me who I am. So to me, that is a very significant spiritual enlightenment. It's very different from the culture of sensitive self individuals. Now, having a very sensitive self is a very highly developed capacity evolutionarily. I mean, my grandparents weren't that sensitive, and if they were, they didn't know. I mean, they're the people who landed on Omaha Beach and had to fight their way to the eagle's nest to get Hitler. It wouldn't have been very good to have been really sensitive. Can you imagine all the guys in the boats, like, before we land, a group hug? Go, before we land, I just want to find out if anyone has anything they'd like to share. Right? I mean, that wouldn't have worked very well. So the thing is, being sensitive in this way, it's a very highly evolved capacity. But we have to transcend it. We have to get beyond it. It's too weak a position for what we're going to be facing as humanity now, what we need to face now, and certainly what we're going to be facing in the next 30 years. What good is it going to be? Do we need another 30 years of psychotherapy and back rubs and... is that what we need? So the point is, what is the context? What is an appropriate context? How are we doing for time, by the way?
7:06.
Okay, so what is the appropriate context of treating Mrs. Jones for her sciatica when her species is threatened with extinction? What's the appropriate context? I'm not saying there's none. I'm asking what is the appropriate context. For me, the appropriate context is evolution of consciousness, evolution of our values, doing anything we can do to bring ourselves and inspire her also to want to join us in moving the whole thing ahead. And we have to get out of the kind of New Age healing we've been in for the last 50, 60 years. It was radical in the 1970s when I started studying Chinese medicine. It really was radical then, but things have gone very much further ahead since then. culturally and in terms of the condition on the planet. And I just think we really have to overcome this and get very serious about really, really waking up. Chinese medicine is a profound medicine for waking up, so I try to put that in my books and teach that in my courses. And for me, it's just always been, that's always where I've connected to the medicine, is at the level of medicine as consciousness. So when I first started studying, there were only four books. You couldn't really, there was Ilsevis Ne Ching when I really first started studying, which is sort of a joke of a translation, but it's impressive she did it in like 1947 or whenever she wrote that. So I had to learn to read classical Chinese and do whatever I could to, because I didn't know that if I just waited 30 years, there'd be 800 books to read. But I would just say to contemplate the message I've given. There are more dimensions of the self. One dimension of the, I haven't really talked about mind. I haven't talked about conscience. I'll be presenting and the soul, which I'll be talking about a bit more this weekend. And I haven't talked about shadow. So shadow is, you know, when you're staring into the sun, which is enlightenment. When you're staring into that, shadow is everything you don't see behind you. It's everything you don't see. So we all need each other for that. None of us can really see that very objectively for ourselves. So for the collective enlightenment we're going to need as a species, we all need each other. So I think one-on-one medicine isn't as relevant as it used to be. I really think medicine has to be global. We have to be the vehicles for it. Who are the people who are most well equipped to solve the problems in the world at this time in history? They're the people in this room. Why? Because we're all global-centric to cosmos-centric, very sophisticated systems thinkers. Anyone in this room could look at a patient and look at potentially... Look at them from the point of view of yin and yang, the three heater, the four divisions of heat, the five elements, six divisions of cold, seven pathogens, eight principles, nine stars, right? The Zhang Fu, 12 officials, right? And look at their lab tests and see absolutely no contradiction. The Chinese never could have done that historically. And most Western physicians can't do that. We're very advanced systems thinkers. We can awaken to the Asian Enlightenment, the East Asian Enlightenment. We can awaken to the Western Enlightenment. And we can hold an enlightenment that goes further and transcends both. We can hold a kind of complexity of points of view. We can hold multiple points of view simultaneously in a way human beings never could before. Never could before. And even if they could potentially, they couldn't because of geographic isolation. There's no way someone in Han China could have held the point of view as a Viking. It's just due to geographic isolation. But now we have access to multiple points of view and a complexity of a consciousness to be able to do that. And it's a very new facility. And that's the kind of systems thinking that we're going to need to form the new political, social, economic systems and environmental systems and social systems that we need to bring economic, political, social justice into the world at this time in history. The people in power now don't have what we've got, so we're going to have to do it, but you can't do it if you're focused on your problem. If you care more about your own wound and your own problem, you just cut the crap. If you're not supposed to eat this, don't eat it. If you're supposed to exercise, go sign up to the gym and just exercise. There's nothing else to work out. Almost everyone who comes to us knows what they're supposed to be doing before they even come. And they're just paying us to tell them. So you've got to already be doing it. You've got to already be doing it. Thank you. Okay. So I am happy for 15 minutes to answer any questions about anything I said or about anything else relative to Chinese medicine. got to be questions. Yes.
How do you feel like angry people who are like, what do you mean my problems aren't real?
Like, well, I didn't say people's problems were real. I mean, that would be uncompassionate. What I was just talking about is the highest and deepest thing I've come to. You're only going to meet, a few people in life interested. But what you got to call people to the center of the bullseye. So in my clinical practice, at any one time, there might be 5 to 10% of my practice engaging me at the level I'm capable of practicing. And as long as people show up on time, play by the are polite, and their checks clear. I treat them. Most people will have no interest in anything I just talked about. But you want to have the capacity to. You want to. The invitation has to be there to take people all the way. And then people will come to different degrees. Someone else had a question. Yes, sir.
It's just such a great joy to study TCM. I think. But in that context, we have stressors inherent, and some of that's relevant. I want to try to point towards the ego, and we have finals next week. So it gets kind of precarious.
If you don't pass your final and your teacher saw you here, what are they going to think? Yeah, you should have been home studying. What were you doing at that Jared thing? Put a bonus point question on authentic self and ego. But I don't understand your question, though. Did you have a question?
Sort of. It's just I see people suffer a lot.
People suffer.
You're alluding to your Jane going down and writing a book, and you sort of watch this process.
Did I seem like I was suffering when I said that?
Thank you.
Well, did I?
No, it seemed like a noble...
What else are we here for,
Sorry?
What else are we here for?
Thank you. Yeah, I was just looking for some help, with wisdom as far as our learning process.
Do you mean, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking me. You seem to be, how old are you?
61.
So it's very impressive. I mean, I tell people all the time I could never do what I've done. I couldn't become me if I had to do it now. I mean, I couldn't learn all the stuff. I mean, I'm sort of incapable of it. So I think it's very impressive that you're doing it. I mean, I'm 55 and I could never learn, go through a graduate school in neurobiology and then learn Chinese medicine and teach myself classical Chinese and do all the stuff that I did in my life at this point in my life. So I would say for you, don't multitask.
It's not about me, thank you. It's more my empathy with students. I've been working at TCM a long time and I just see a lot of casualties,
Well, casualties in TCM, I mean, people are dying in Darfur and I mean, I wouldn't worry too much about the Californian TCM casualties. As I said, we're the source of our own suffering. Geez, you go to Chinese medical school, you're probably in the top 1% of all fortunate humans who've ever lived. I would think.
But I think it sounds in a way that you're talking about sort of spirit overrides everything. Yet it seems like what Chinese medicine is saying is that for Jingshan, that they're linked.
Well, I talked about Jingshan. It's emptiness and luminosity. And Jing is emptiness and Shen is luminosity. So Jing is the infinite ocean and Shen is the spark that activates. Tang Shen Ming, right? Tang Shen Ming? Tang Shen Ming?
Tang Shen Ming.
The superior, the classics say, right, the superior physician work has the capacity of Tang Shen Ming. So here we have the character that would be in Tao. It just means path. This is on all Chinese money. So it just means to exchange. But in a deeper way, it means to be interpenetrated with. Two things as one. Two things, so they're inextricably linked, so that you only have one thing. Shen is heaven, one. Earth, two. Moon, star, sun. So that's three with two hands lowering a rope. So it's heaven extending its will to us as light, as lightning. The moon, star, sun, the portents of what will be. So heaven, earth, moon, star, sun, the one, the two, the three. This is the state of chaos before creation. Right? The three, one gives birth to two, two gives birth to three. It's the three that gives birth to the 10,000 things. And then Ming is the character of gallbladder 24. It's the sun and the moon. It means enlightenment. So to be one with the spiritual brightness of Shen, to be illuminated by, to be one with at the level of consciousness, at the level of your consciousness, Shen, to be enlightened. And the texts say the superior physician works through Tang Shen Ming. So I'm not saying that spirit is everything, but it seems important.
Absolutely. But on the other hand, in this aspect of Chinese culture, mm-hmm. or Chinese medicine, they're talking about, you can talk about Taoism, or Buddhism came in later and all that. It's, mm-hmm. you know, a lot about that and perhaps the superiority of that. It's very hierarchical in Chinese culture. Nevertheless, the other aspect of Chinese culture and Chinese medicine is extreme materialism.
Yeah.
And working perhaps towards that through materialism.
The planet's dying. We don't have time. So there has to be a spiritual awakening.
So, but we do it through sticking needles in a point on the material body.
No, you do it through who you are, actually. The needles can just serve who you are. They can just serve, needles and herbs can just serve who you are. So if the purpose of medicine, I would understand Chinese medicine to be a science and medicine of integrity. So Chinese diagnosis is about diagnosing how yin and yang have lost integrity with each other and of bringing yin and yang back into integrity with each other. But all of that is a metaphor. And if a person's own will is not on board with this greater integrity, then everything you're doing is just palliative. And that's all right. I mean, it's all right to help ease people suffering in that way. But I don't know, our priorities have to be a little different at the end of the world. Now, I think every generation has probably thought things look pretty bad. They can't get much worse than this. But it is different now because we actually have the technology to destroy all life on the planet, which they never did. So it's reasonable that some physician in a hamlet in China 500 years ago during a typhoid epidemic who saw 70% of his village die would have thought the world was coming to an end. But there's no way that the epidemic could have crossed the oceans. No way it could have gotten to Europe, do you see? So, but now, you know, the Japanese are very smart and they built the Fukushima nuclear power plant and you guys are getting irradiated by it. So the thing is, we can understand historically that medical problems were individual, but they're not anymore. The biggest survival challenges of the species are no longer coming from outside of us. They're not just weather. The biggest survival challenges that face us are being created by human beings. So they're questions of consciousness. So look, I mean, when a new patient comes to me, I spend an hour and a half, I do a 40-minute pulse diagnosis. The pulse system I use has 85 qualities, 9 different depths and 50 places to put your finger. I'm doing a physiology so far beyond anything in TCM. By TCM, I mean since 1948 in China. So I'm doing profound physiology and looking at the body, and yes, we're working through the body. But the thing that's motivating the body, that force of life that's motivating it, needs to be rectified. And the person has to become aware of that rectification and take responsibility for maintaining it and know why they're doing it, or everything else we're doing is just on the outside. So what I'm advocating for is that we should just be doing it ourselves, certainly not forcing anything on anyone, but that our lives as practitioners of the medicine should be exemplary of the kind of wholeness the medicine predicts is possible. Okay, and one more. We have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
Teilhard de Chardin, in his book called The Phenomenon of Man,
yes, I've
talks
read
about
it.
The omega.
He's buried 30 minutes from my house.
Oh, really?
He's one of my favorite guys.
Yeah.
So he talks about the omega point.
Omega point. And mm-hmm. then Lama Surya Das, the Tibetan, I mean the American guy, but
I know
Tibetan
him.
Monk.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about, in his dream yoga, about this lucidity, the light, and mm-hmm. the shunyata, the emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
And Matthew Fox was talking about leashing our reptilian brain, because that's the ego you define that creates havoc, you know, chaos and all that.
Well, at our level of development, I would say ego's gone far beyond the reptilian brain. Like at our, for most people in here, ego manifests as you have your truth, I have my truth, and nobody knows the truth. So I can do whatever I want and you can't judge me.
Okay, so...
So a reptile couldn't formulate
in
that.
In this journey, it prevents you from actualizing yourself that you were talking about, the emptiness and the luminosity. So my question is this, what is the key thing we have to do or not do to realize that potential, innate potential we have in ourself, to realize that void from which everything started, you know?
Well, what's your experience right now in the room? So what's your experience right now? Like right
my
here, right?
No, my mind
right.
Talks.
Okay, forgetting them completely.
Yeah.
How has the talk been? How's the talk been?
The talk was very meaningful to me.
Okay, so what's your experience of that?
The experience of there was a kind of...
No, now. Not what it was, just right now.
A kind of oneness. I could relate to you. When you sat there with your eyes closed,
mm-hmm.
like a cat waiting for the mouse to come out of the mouse hole. I wish more of us could do that. You know, you did it.
So, what's in the way?
Hmm?
What's in the way?
I can't hear.
What's in the way? You said you wish more of us could do that. What's in the way?
What's in the way is our...
Nothing.
No, I don't think it's nothing.
No, but I'm saying...
It is our illusory or deluded belief in separation of I and we.
Yes,
and
but I'm working with you.
Yeah.
So all of that's abstract.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing in the way here.
No friction, no resistance.
Well, what's your experience? Like right now, what's your experience? Are things good?
The experience is that what I was experiencing this morning.
No.
Different than here is discursive thought, and we are trying to entangle into a dialogue where we have to communicate using a language that is actually in its absolutes. Real self, ineffable and non-communicable, you know. But we are still trying to develop an approximate model, you know.
Language is one of the most highly developed capacities in the universe.
Yes, it's part of our evolutionary self, but I think we have to create that empty mind, you know. There are no thoughts, because the language is...
But you're not doing it right now.
Doing what?
You're not doing it right. So what would it mean to do that right now?
Right now?
Empty yes. mind.
Empty the mind and just sit still. And I wish we can do a small meditation, spend a couple of...
What did we just do for an hour and a half?
A couple of moments of observing our incoming breath and the outgoing breath, because I think that can really center us, you know. I mean, all this talking is fine, but ultimately...
No, but so two people are talking to me. So one man who's talking to me was deeply moved by what happened here, and something happened that he recognized that was deeply moving, and in that there's no problem. And in that, there's exactly what this other part of yourself is denying, saying it's looking for it and it needs something else to happen. So there are two, there's a division, do you see? So let's just go right now with the part where there's no problem. And let's just stay there.
So that's what Buddha talks about in Dhammapada, I think. He's saying, let go of the heart and...
I know.
It's a shadow.
I know, but...
Yeah. This is profound. Very similar to what you're talking about. Very similar. Houston Smith said that book is E equals MC square of Buddhism.
I know. I know all these cats. But okay, so anyway, a few things. So I do have a few books here if people are interested. I am giving a seminar this weekend if people would like to come. I have an online community with about 3,000 acupuncturists at nourishingdestiny.com. Membership on the discussion board's free. There's tons and tons of videos and audios of me teaching with Heiner Fruhoff or Zev Rosenberg, Elizabeth Rochat, all different, Will Morris from Austin, and all different fantastic teachers. So anyway, you're more than welcome there. I'll be coming back to Berkeley. I teach twice a year. I teach a two-year course. Four or five of the people in the room fly in for it. You're all welcome to take this if you're interested. Anyway, look, thank you for indulging me. It's been my pleasure being here. God bless, and travel safely. Be well. Thank you very much.